If you would please join me in Isaiah chapter 14. We're going to scroll back a little bit to verse number 12. And I want to remind you again that Isaiah has revealed prophetically that Babylon will eventually be used by God to judge Judah. And now he is revealing prophetically that shortly after that, God will judge Babylon by the Medes and the Persians. And of course, the king of Babylon, particularly the last one, who is a very, very braggadocious and egomaniacal individual, he is going to be the focus of taunts from the Jewish people after they have returned to their promised land many years later. And in the midst of this taunt against the dead king of Babylon, we seem to see the puppeteer behind the scenes, and that would be Satan, the one who's stirring the pot. And so I want to share with you again real quick in a review what many of us believe is kind of behind the scenes in this passage. And it also helps explain where certain words have come into English usage within the church. So Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12, "How you have fallen from heaven, O day star," or the Hebrew is Halel, which is a reference to the planet Venus as the morning star, just as it's above the horizon before dawn. So, "How have you fallen from heaven, Halel," or the Latin here is where we get our word Lucifer, light bringer or light bearer. And of course, that's a reference to Satan prior to his fall from being one of God's good angels. And that happened during Genesis chapter 3, there in the Garden of Eden. Some have thought, and I tend to agree with this, that when God made mankind in his image and likeness, he instructed the angels to treat Adam and Eve as they would treat him, that is, the creator of eternity. And that this got in the craw of Satan and apparently a few other angels. And Satan himself decided to rebel and to lead in a coup attempt against God. And what he did to Eve was the first shot in that coup. Verse number 12 again. "How you have fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the dawn, how you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low." And that will eventually be true. He will be pulled all the way down. Book of Revelation indicates that Satan and his angels will be kicked out of the supernatural realm into the physical realm shortly before Jesus comes back, about 3.5 years before Jesus comes back. But this next part describes his mindset at the time of his rebellion. "You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven above the stars of God." Stars are symbolic for angels very often. "I will set my throne on high. I will sit on the mount of assembly in the far reaches of the north." Some of your Bibles might actually have Zaphon here, which is just Hebrew for north. And it's perhaps a cultural reference to Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon was the highest mountain in the Middle East near Israel, and it's north of Israel proper. Some commentators point out that the peoples of India think about the gods living in the Himalayas to the north of them. And the Greeks in the Greek peninsula thought about their gods living on Mount Olympus to the north of them. So this might be some sort of cultural reference here, that the northern highest mountain was where the gods lived. And so Satan is pictured as basically trying to have a coup against God. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I'll make myself like the Most High. So that's his big claim, is I will be like God. And of course, that's the lie he used with Eve when he corrupted her by saying, hey, you know what the real problem is? God does not want you to become like him. He's holding out on you. That's why he doesn't want you to eat of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And of course, we know how all that turned out. It's been horrible since then. But thanks be to God, Jesus Christ reversed the curse. And we will see an end to all of that with the wrap-up when Jesus Christ comes back. Okay, but now in the text in Isaiah, we kind of go back to the sense of the human king of Babylon, how he's going to end up dead. Now, Satan is going to end up in hell as well. So there's a little bit of that playing out here. But I think mostly the taunt goes back to talking about how the king of Babylon, who thought he was so important, so in charge, ends up being dead. Verse number 15, but you are brought down to Sheol, the place of the dead, to the far reaches of the pit. Those who see you will stare at you and ponder over you. Is this the man who made the earth tremble? Who shook kingdoms? Who made the world like a desert and overthrew its cities? Who did not let his prisoners go home? So all of those are the sorts of things that the kings of Babylon will be known for, exercising great power and authority. And yet now, this one in particular is dead. Verse 18, all the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb, but you are cast away from your grave like a loathed branch, clothed with the slain, those pierced by the sword who go down to the stones of the pit like a dead body trampled underfoot. Apparently, this last king of Babylon that was there, having the party banquet with Daniel, interpreting the writing on the wall with the disembodied hand. That guy, because Babylon gets overrun at his time, doesn't get the big state funeral that he would have wanted. Verse number 20, you will not be joined with them in burial because you've destroyed your land. You have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers nevermore be named. Prepare slaughter for his sons because of the guilt of their fathers, lest they rise and possess the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. So this long-term curse put upon that family line of the final king of Babylon. Verse 22, I will rise up against them, declares he who is over the armies, and will cut off from Babylon name and remnant, descendants and posterity, says he who is, and I will make it a possession of the hedgehog and pools of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares he who is of the hosts, or over the armies. And that's, again, getting back to the prophecy we saw earlier, that once Babylon falls, it will deteriorate, and even the capital city itself will be buried in the debris of time. And it wasn't even found again until fairly modern history. And even now, nothing is being built up on that particular site for it to be, you know, a great city again. Now, Assyria comes up in the next part of the prophecy. Verse 24, he who is of the hosts has sworn, as I have planned, so shall it be. As I've purposed, so shall it stand, that I will break the Assyrian in my land and on my mountain trample him underfoot, and his yoke shall depart from them and his burden from their shoulder. Now, in the time of Isaiah, the Assyrians were the big troublemaker. And God's prophecy was the Assyrians were to come to an end, and they were going to not be able to take the city of Jerusalem. We talked about that before. So here we have more of that promise. This is the purpose, that is purpose concerning the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out over all the nations. For he who is of the hosts has purposed, and who will annul it? His hand is stretched out, and who will turn it back? So when God decides to do something, no one is going to be able to put a stop to that. Now, we already read the last part of chapter 14 because it's dated to the year that King Ahaz died, and we did that time period already. Chapter 15 then goes to another country of the Middle Eastern region that is under God's judgment, and it has a whole bunch of names thrown in here. Biggest thing you just understand is these are places in the country of Moab, which is effectively the eastern side of the Dead Sea. So it's in modern-day Saudi Arabia, and I think a little bit of Jordan, maybe. So verse 1 of chapter 15, an oracle concerning Moab. Because Ar of Moab is laid waste at a night, Moab is undone. So Ar is one of the big cities. Because Kir of Moab is laid waste in a night, Moab is undone. He has gone up to the temple and to Dibon, to the high places to weep over Nebo, over Medeba. Moab wails. So once the judgment of God comes on this area, through the Assyrians and then through other progressive kingdoms after that, there will be mourning and wailing by the sinful Moabites. On every head is baldness, every beard is shorn. Sometimes a person does that to themselves to show grief. Other times it's done to them because they've become slaves. In the streets they wear sackcloth. On the housetops and in the squares, everyone wails and melts in tears. So everybody's crying. Heshbon and Elilah cry out. Their voice is heard as far as Jahaz. And therefore the armed men of Moab cry aloud. His soul trembles. My heart cries out for Moab. Her fugitives flee to Zoar. Now that's interesting because Zoar is the place where Lot was supposed to flee to in the destruction of the cities of the plain. And it was the only city of the ones slated for destruction that survived because of that. So here you have people running off to that place in the southern end of the Dead Sea Valley. To Eglat Shalishiya, for at the ascent of Luhit, they go up weeping. On the road to Horonaim, they raise a cry of destruction. So now we picture the refugees fleeing out of the area, trying to get away from the invaders. The waters of Nimrim are a desolation. The grass is withered. The vegetation fails. The greenery is no more. So it's not just invaders that were part of the judgment against them. They also were under a famine and a drought sent by the Lord. Therefore, the abundance they have gained and what they've laid up, they carry away over the brook of the willows. For a cry has gone around the land of Moab. Her wailing reaches Eglaim. Her wailing reaches to Beer Elim. For the waters of Dibon are full of blood. For I will bring upon Dibon even more, a lion for those of Moab who escape, for the remnant of the land. So a lot of judgment, a lot of trouble, including death. Chapter 16, send the lamb to the ruler of the land from Selah by way of the desert to the mount of the daughters of Zion. Now, that is also historically interesting. At one time, Moab was tributary to Judea, and they sent many lambs and rams and wool to Jerusalem. And some of those lambs would have been used in worship to God. And so here they are coming under the judgment, in part because of the way they treated the Israeli people. And some of their stuff will end up over at Jerusalem. Verse 2, like fleeing birds, like a scattered nest, so are the daughters of Moab at the fords of the Arnon. Give counsel. Grant justice. Make your shade like night at the height of noon. Shelter the outcast. Do not reveal the fugitive. So this is all the stuff that should be done. You know, take care of people that are having a tough time. Let the outcasts of Moab sojourn among you. Be a shelter to them from the destroyer. When the oppressor is no more and destruction has ceased, and he who tramples underfoot has vanished from the land, then a throne will be established in steadfast love, and on it will sit in faithfulness in the tent of David, one who judges and seeks justice and is swift to do righteousness. So smack dab in the middle of this, talk about refugees. Moabite refugees who cross over to Judea, one of the few places that the Assyrians are not going to be able to take into their empire. When they get there, they're supposed to be treated kindly. And some of them will respond well to that and kind of become part of the Judean kingdom. And eventually, what happens at Judea? The tent of David is set back up again. That is, the Messiah shows up, Jesus. And he will judge rightly. He will seek justice. He will do the right thing. And that is, of course, going to be ultimately true in the millennial kingdom when Jesus comes back to rule and reign with his resurrected and transformed saints. Back to a little bit more of Moabite critique by God. We have heard of the pride of Moab, how proud he is of his arrogance, his pride, and his insolence. In all his idle boasting, he is not right. Therefore, let Moab wail for Moab. Let everyone wail. Mourn, utterly stricken, for the raisin cakes of Kir Hareshet. So, pride is part of the problem that brings judgment. And this reference here to raisin cakes is more than likely a reference to religious offerings made to pagan deities. And so that pride also includes false faith. Verse 8, for the fields of Heshbon languish, and the vine of Sibmah, the lords of the nations have struck down its branches, which reached to Jazir and strayed to the desert. Its shoots spread abroad and passed over the sea. So again, we've got this poetry where Moab is like a plant, but now it's shriveling up. It used to spread everywhere, but now it's being done in by the judgment of God. Verse 9, therefore I weep with the weeping of Jazer for the vine of Sibmah. I drench you with my tears, O Heshbon and Eliah, for over your summer fruit and your harvest the shout has ceased. Joy and gladness are taken away from the fruitful field, and in the vineyards no song are sung. No cheers are raised, no treader treads out wine in the presses. The things you often see in countries that still do big community harvests of grapes, and they're treading the vintage out, you know, barefooted and things like that. That sort of stuff was going on in the Middle East. And it brought a lot of joy, a lot of happiness, and a lot of camaraderie and all that's gone. When the judgment of God falls, there's nothing to be happy about. The crop fails, is no more, and people are taken away. Verse 11, therefore my inner parts mourn like a lyre for Moab, and my inmost self for Kir Hareseth. So Isaiah perhaps, but God also portrayed here as crying like the sound of a sad musical instrument over the judgment that has to fall on Moab. And when Moab presents himself, when he wearies himself on the high places, when he comes to his sanctuary to pray, he will not prevail. So the false worship that was going on was not going to get them out of this trouble. This is the word that he who has spoke against Moab in the past. But now he who has spoken, saying, in 3 years, like the years of a hired worker, the glory of Moab will be brought into contempt in spite of all his great multitude, and those who remain will be very few and feeble. So whenever it was that Isaiah released this information, spoke this information about Moab, 3 years later, it all came to pass, and the Assyrians swept through the area and kind of did in the kingdom of Moab. Now, the next chapter, we already did when we were talking about the Syrians coming against the northern kingdom of Israel, and how there's a future prophecy about the destruction of Damascus. We'll skip down to chapter 18 now, which focuses on Cush, or Ethiopia, perhaps. Chapter 18, land of whirring wings that is beyond the rivers of Cush. Now, the whirring wings here, is that a reference to birds? Is that a reference to grasshoppers? It's apparently something that made sense to those that would receive this prophecy. Which sends ambassadors by the sea in vessels of papyrus on the waters. And we know that they make or made at this time ships along the Nile out of papyrus. Go, you swift messengers, to a nation tall and smooth, to a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the rivers divide. Now that's a reference to the Babylonians again, to the Mesopotamian peoples. Mesopotamia means the land between two rivers. So this prophecy is against Cush down in Africa, but it is referencing people up in Mesopotamia. All you inhabitants of the world, you who dwell on the earth, when a signal is raised on the mountains, look. When a trumpet is blown, hear. For thus he who is said to me, I will quietly look from my dwelling, like clear heat in sunshine, like a cloud of dew in the heat of harvest. For before the harvest, when the blossom is over and the flower becomes a ripening grape, he cuts off the shoots with pruning hooks, and the spreading branches he lops off and clears away. So now we're back to the agricultural similes. That judgment that God is going to pour out on Cush is going to be like somebody coming into a vineyard and cutting the vines to pieces right before they can reach their peak. And so that's what's going to happen to Cush. Verse 6, they shall all of them be left to the birds of prey of the mountains, to the beasts of the earth, and the birds of prey will summer on them, and all the beasts of the earth will winter on them. So again, the predatory animals or the scavenger animals come in. In this case, that references how the Cushites will end up being taken away piecemeal into exile. At that time, tribute will be brought to he who is over the armies, from a people tall and smooth, from a people feared near and far, a nation mighty and conquering, whose land the rivers divide, to Mount Zion, the place of the name of he who is over the armies. And so apparently there are some prophecies here about the restoration from Mesopotamia to the Promised Land by the Israelis. And we know that once the Medes and the Persians kind of took over Mesopotamia, they ended up sending back many of the descendants of those that had gone into exile under the Assyrians and under the Babylonians. And there was this rebuilding of the Jewish nation from those returns. And that seems to be prophesied right here. Chapter 19, which we'll just barely get started on, it says an oracle, you know, a burden, something to be delivered concerning Egypt. Behold, he who is riding on a swift cloud and comes to Egypt. So here comes God against the Egyptians in judgment. And the idols of Egypt will tremble at his presence, and the heart of the Egyptians will melt within them. So when the real God brings his judgment against the fake gods always lose. Remember, the last big confrontation that happened was with Moses acting as God's agent, and many, many of the plagues were directed against multiple gods and goddesses of the Egyptians and made them look like fools because they could not stop the God of the Israelis from doing whatever it is he wanted to do. Well, because we're out of time, we'll go ahead and mark our place here at chapter 19, and we'll get back into the Word as God gives us the ability.